I'm Jeffrey Church from the Department of Political Science at the University of Houston. This is the Political Theory Review, a podcast of conversations with authors of recent books in political theory and social and political philosophy. Today I'm talking to Nicholas Tampio, Associate Professor of Political Science at Fordham University. We're discussing his 2018 book, Common Core, National Education Standards and the Threat to Democracy, from Johns Hopkins University Press. Tampio works on the history of political thought with particular emphasis on modern continental theory from Kant through Deleuze. He is the author of Kantian Courage and Deleuze's Political Vision. First, let me say thanks so much, Nick, for joining me on the Political Theory Review.
Glad to be here.
So, Nick, this is a great book. I loved it in part, although this isn't the only reason, but I have a young kid in kindergarten. So this was really eye-opening and really actually kind of bracing. So I found it really very convincing about the democratic shortfall of the Common Core curriculum. It's obviously, as you can tell from the title, Critique of the Common Core, but you quite nicely give the best case you can for it. So I found this all very interesting. So let me ask, first of all, what led you to write the book? What motivated you to write the book in the first place?
Okay, sure. So let me just start off by saying that I really wrote this book for parents. And I gave a talk on Long Island a couple of years ago. And one mother who organized this event where she asked me to speak, they had printed out one of my articles, like popular articles in Al Jazeera America. And she was thanking me, and she looked me in the eye and she said, "I read your article 8 times. And I was like, "You're my audience for everything I'm going to write on the Common Core." So like, I'm going to write it as smart as I can in a way that parents can understand if they're willing to work a little bit. So right before I submitted it, I took out all the extraneous academic references I could. Right. So there's no references to John Rawls or Habermas or Arendt I took out all those and really just said, listen, I just want to help parents, and they need arguments to explain why this is not working for them or, perhaps the country as a whole. So to answer your question about how I got involved in it, I'm one of many parents whose lives have been turned upside down by the Common Core. That, there was two political scientists who wrote a book about President Obama's education agenda, and they called the Common Core stealth national standards. And this was really a project designed and orchestrated behind closed doors. And it was sort of sprung on the American people in such a way as to not allow there to be a public debate and to try to cement it before parents could react or oppose it. And so it was really, from my perspective, an anti-democratic maneuver to transform American public education. I'll say real quick, this is not a conspiracy theory. A conspiracy requires secrets. A conspiracy requires things to be done without anybody knowing. And the spring of 2014, the Washington Post ran this article by Lindsay Layden called "How Bill Gates Pulled Off the Swift Common Core Revolution." And there's a video of Bill Gates explaining his participation in this. And a lot of people talked with Lindsay Layden for the Washington Post about what they were doing. So the fact is, this is in the public, that I really made sure in my book to document every statement I could. There is so much wrong with the Common Core on its face that you don't need to go to conspiracy theories. You just need to do your homework. You just need to read the articles, read the documents, follow the plot line that is available in publicly accessible articles and documents. So, part of what happened is that, my kid's education was affected. So you've got a kindergartner. My kid's kindergarten experience was radically transformed by the Common Core. My oldest son was a kindergartner, and he was sort of a play-based Montessori kindergarten experience in the fall of 2011. And then in the spring of 2012, New York started to implement the Common Core. And the teacher now had to use scripted lesson plans that aligned with the Common Core. Mm-hmm. And for years now, education reformers, that's kind of the term for people who tend to support the Common Core and testing and accountability mechanisms, education reformers have said the standards are good, but the implementation's the problem. So whenever a parent has a problem, it's because of the kindergarten teacher or because of the school. And part of my book is the thesis is parents are protesting when the Common Core standards are implemented faithfully. So the fact is that the standards are 100% part of the problem. And so part of my book's purpose is to really give parents the scholarly ammunition they need to fight this fight. And so when they meet with principals, when they meet with Board of Regents, when they meet with superintendents, when they meet with legislators, if they ever get the ear of members of Congress, they have to tell them the standards are 100% of part of the problem.
So I thought first we could maybe talk a little bit about what the Common Core is. Maybe you could say a little bit about the history of national education standards, and then what distinguishes the Common Core, how it emerged.
Okay, that's excellent. So there's a long story. Let me just try to give a couple of the highlights of it. So when America was founded, education was nominally or officially a state's power, right? That they didn't enumerate education as a federal power in the Constitution. And the 10th Amendment says that power is unenumerated powers belong to the states, right? So they very easily could have enumerated education as a policy, but they very much didn't. And so legally, it was a states' rights thing, but practically, it was overwhelmingly a local matter. And historians have written interesting books on basically how the beginning of the 19th century, you see the rise of the common school movement that's largely being led by states, but some also localities, and they're building a public school system. So Horace Mann in Massachusetts is the most famous, but there are a lot of other people who are partaking in this movement. So it's still overwhelmingly a local control. But what really shifts things is the Elementary and Secondary Education Act of 1965. And that was a pillar of Lyndon Baines Johnson's Great Society program. And that, I think in 1 year, I don't remember exactly, the number's escaping me, but basically the spending went up to $1 billion. Federal government spending on education went up to $1 billion and much, much more than it had been in previous years. And so really the story is for the past 50 years, you're just seeing a steady ramping up of the federal participation in education. 2001, President George W. Bush signs the No Child Left Behind Act, and that says that all states are supposed to use standards, test the standards, and hold schools accountable for the results of the testing. So the No Child Left Behind is this really is a very big step up of upwards of more federal participation in education. No Child Left Behind Act allowed, at least in theory, each state to have its own set of education standards. So what an education standard is that it says by the end of a particular grade, students should be able to perform these activities. So what they should be able to do in literacy and numeracy and also in science. So this is No Child Left Behind. It says, what are the performance expectations that each child must be able, in that state must be able to perform? Now, if you believe in systemic education reform, the notion that all of the parts of our education system in our country should fit together like a clock where all the pieces sync up, you can't have 50 set of education standards. So education reformers have been pushing, and they got a big break with the Obama administration's Race to the Top program. And Race to the Top was a competitive grants program that said that states could win a grant if they adopted common college and career ready standards. And they were actually not written when Race to the Top got started. So lots of states signed memorandums of understanding, including New York, to adopt the standards before the standards were even released. So talk about no evidence that they actually worked. There literally could not have been evidence, just temporally, in New York, the governor signed the Memorandum of Understanding in January of 2009, and the standards themselves were published in the summer of 2009. So it was really there was no evidence about what the standards would accomplish or what they would even be. So what Race to the Top did is it provided a cover for states all around the country to adopt the same education standards. And, you know, there's one thesis that states were forced to adopt Race to the Top or apply to Race to the Top because it was the height of the Great Recession. And so I do think that plays a part of it, but I also think that Race to the Top justified the education reform agenda to create national education standards. So the fact was, is in New York, the chancellor of the Board of Regents, Merrill Tisch, was just very excited about this. Like, I don't need to talk about my hunch. I'll just say my hunch. My hunch was she would have applied for this even if there was no money involved. But as it turned out, New York won a $700 million Race to the Top grant. So listen, there are good arguments for national education standards, right? And so I don't want to make it sound like there's no good arguments, right? So there are good reasons that Americans should have good performance expectations for all students in the country. It's like there's a certain prima facie logic to it. But once the rubber hits the road, then all of a sudden parents see a problem. And then the big question is the problem the common core or is the problem the very idea of creating a national set of education standards?
Yeah. And just to be clear on how the common core is enforced, it's largely, you could say, through a carrot rather than a stick mechanism, right? So that is that the national, why do localities are presumably free to accept these standards or not, right? Or no?
No.
No, they're not.
Okay. No, they're 100% not. I mean, and we have to separate the question of how states adopted them and then how they're enforced. So, the question is states were all hurting financially in 2009 and Race to the Top offer to give them additional funds. And then also No Child Left Behind required all students to achieve proficiency in literacy and numeracy, I think by 2013. I would need to double check. But so the fact is that states, if they wanted Title I funds, they had to get a No Child Left Behind waiver. And if they wanted a Race to the Grant Top funds, they would have to apply for a grant. So, you know, forced is not exactly the right word, but I would say strongly incentivized to adopt the national standard. So, so quickly, pretty much every state, there's two exceptions, maybe two and a half with Minnesota, but they're Virginia and Texas are the kind of exceptions. We can talk about that later, but basically every state in the country adopted the Common Core in 2009 and 2010. Now the question is, how did they get locked in? And that's a big question. But just the short of it is that each state gets money from the federal government for communities with historically disadvantaged communities. So communities that have a lot of poverty, they get what's called Title I funds. So, all across the country, there are Title I schools that get federal money. And so states such as New York, in certain poor communities, they have a lot of Title I funds. And so the state has a financial incentive to get federal funds to allocate resources to those Title I schools. So part of the issue is that states, to get federal funding, they have to promise that all schools within that state are going to use the standards, take the tests, and be held accountable.
Mm-hmm. And then the states, then so if particular school districts, right, say, you know, the test refusal movement you allude to near the end of the book, if particular schools don't follow through or don't perform well, then what do states then resort to as a way to enforce compliance?
Okay, sure. Well, I immersed myself in the literature more theoretical about systemic school reform. And then I read the legislation and the rules and the policies that explained the nitty gritty details. So what No Child Left Behind had, which was taken up in the next reauthorization of the Elementary and Secondary Education Act, this was known as the Every Student Succeeds Act, ESSA. So ESSA is the main federal law right now that stipulates what states have to do if they want federal funds. And pretty much every state, no, 100%, every state in America gets Title I funds. And so this is, and even communities that don't have Title I schools still get some funds from this program, right? That's a way to gain legitimacy. My local congressperson sends out a flyer saying how much money they get under Title I, which is a little bit absurd considering how wealthy this area is. So, but you know, it was smart politics to get people to support this program. So what here's where things stand is that the bottom 5% of the schools that take the tests, the state has to come up with a plan to turn around the lowest performing schools. And so one of the main ways that they can do, I mean, there's a schedule what states have to require districts to do. This can include getting new programs, bringing in consultants, firing half the staff and the principal, or firing everybody in the district and giving it to the control of a private manager or a charter school. So that's one of the sticks that the states can use under No Child Left Behind in ESSA, which is if the students don't do well enough on the tests, the state can take over the school and make it into a charter school. So, now the big question is, well, what about the test refusal movement? And so there was virtually no public debate about the Common Core before New York adopted it or other states adopted it. And so one of the only ways that parents can express their resistance is to refuse the Common Core tests. And so now, you know, the chapter is still being written right now about what states have to do to school districts with high test refusal rates. So the law requires schools to administer the tests to at least 95% of the students who are in that state. Now the question is, what happens if, say, 10-20% of the students refuse to take the tests? So that's what happened in New York right now in past years. So there's no school district, I believe, in New York State, or is that right? No school district? I think that's right. No school district in New York State that satisfies the 95% test participation rate. So the question is, what is the federal government going to do to states that continue to have a high test refusal number? And so, you know, we would have to get into the specifics. Even this morning, I saw on social media that people in New York were trying to figure out what Betsy DeVos was doing regarding New York's ESSA plan regarding test refusal rates. So I'm a little bit unsure, just because I want to follow up, because I thought that Betsy DeVos approved New York's ESSA plan, but somebody posted on social media that she's concerned about the test participation rate provisions. So, you know, I think for the point of this conversation, the point remains that the federal government can threaten to withhold funds if people don't take the tests.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, I ask these questions because I'm in part interested in the politics of it, obviously. If one agrees with your conclusions, you know, one is led, I think, to the question about what to do about it. And it seems like there are a couple different options here, either test refusal, I suppose lobbying one state government one state officials to not accept the grants from the federal government. But no states, you said, have done that, right?
At this moment, I'm not especially hopeful. Yeah. You know what I mean? No. It's not clear exactly what the path is out of here. I spend a lot of time teaching the Every Student Succeeds Act, and I've spent a lot of time reading it. And, you know, one of the calling cards of ESSA was that, okay, the state, it officially says that states, that the Secretary of Education cannot interfere with the state's decision about what academic standards to adopt. And so actually ESSA says the Secretary of Education is not allowed to tell states that they have to use the Common Core. So what this did is, I mean, this is my interpretation. This provided cover to certain primarily Republican members of Congress who said, listen, we're supporting ESSA because it stops the federal Common Core mandate. So Senator Lamar Alexander, who is one of the sponsors of ESSA, he said this bill represents the greatest return to local control in 25 years. And then even this past week, I think, this week or 2 weeks, Betsy DeVos spoke at the American Enterprise Institute. Betsy DeVos is Donald Trump's Secretary of Education. And DeVos said that the Common Core is over, at least on the federal level. And, you know, if you're paying any attention, you'll realize that pretty much every state in America still uses the Common Core. And even in Texas, a lot of big cities have adopted the Common Core. And, Virginia did not adopt the Common Core, but the standards are still pretty similar. We can, speculate about why that's the case, basically because you need skills that are easy to test on computers. So I don't think the Virginia standards are all that different, although they are different. So the fact is that the ESSA does not require states to adopt the Common Core, but ESSA came out in 2015 when most states had already adopted the Common Core. So the relevant question is, what can states do to get out of the Common Core? And just to go ahead to the conclusion of this point that I'm making, no states under ESSA have abandoned the Common Core. Mm-hmm. And ESSA has all sorts of stipulations about what kind of standards states can use. They have to be challenging academic standards. Sometimes there's reference to college and career ready standards. Sometimes there's a reference to workforce readiness training standards, which have often been synonymous with the Common Core standards. So the fact of the matter is that, you know, I'm in social media debates, the fights, whatever, quarrels on social media. And, you know, I tell people who support the Common Core who work at think tanks, I say, unless you can actually show me a state that has left the Common Core, I'm going to stick with my reading of ESSA that the writers had no interest in helping states escape the Common Core. So, I mean, refusing the tests is a short-term strategy to make it a live political issue, right? It's not solving the problem. What it's basically doing is it's signaling that this is a problem that policy entrepreneurs need to solve. Mm-hmm. So we need politicians to come in and say, listen, we're going to really get the heck out of the Common Core. We need to keep building up that pressure. And, yeah. So, I mean, the best that can happen in the short term is that, the resistance is so big that states don't drop the hammer on school districts that have high test refusal rates. And in the medium term, the best results is that the Congress rewrites the Elementary and Secondary Education Act. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So let's shift to your case against the Common Core. And you start by talking in general about national education standards. This is a sort of the high theory part of the book before you get into some of the details of the Common Core, which I also found fascinating too. And I want to talk about some of those too. But so in chapters 2 and 3, you talk about the case for having national education standards in general, not necessarily the Common Core, but just in general, the idea of national education standards. And then in chapter 3, the case against national education standards. So I thought we could talk about, you know, why one might think that having national education standards would be good for a democracy. So what are the benefits? You talk about 4 arguments for and 4 arguments against. So I thought we could briefly go through them because they're all quite interesting. The first argument for having a national education standard, you call the systemic argument, that national standards can render coherent the curriculum. Right, what students are learning. Otherwise, leaving it up to local control leads to chaos. Maybe you could say a little bit more about what the chaotic nature of local control is. Like, what's the chaos that we should be worried about on this argument that's at the local level?
So I think you have to consider an argument in its strongest form before you can defeat it, right? Because I don't want to attack straw people and then readers of my book are like, well, you didn't consider these really good arguments, and therefore I'm still going to support standard. So I really tried to present the strongest arguments. And one of the key texts is by this person named Mike Smith and Jennifer O'Day. They wrote this article in 1989 called Systemic School Reform. And this is, for me, the most important philosophical text defending national education standards. And what it's saying is that if you have national education standards, you can link up every single part of the education school system based on these standards. So I think actually in the text they call them curriculum frameworks, but it's basically standards. So now what you can do is you can train teachers into these standards. You can do professional development for teachers using these standards. You can have tests using these standards. You can hold school districts accountable for their results using these tests aligned to these standards. You can even go so far as to start thinking, I mean, I don't know how much they talk about this in the text, but the sort of the logic of school reform is you can start thinking about kindergarten and pre-kindergarten to connect up to the K-12 standards. Then you can start thinking about college standards. And actually you could start thinking about early career standards. So, you know, you and I are familiar with K-12. Now there's K-16. Mm-hmm. Now there's P, which can sometimes mean preschool or actually sometimes prenatal, to 20. So 4 years after you should normally graduate from college. So, you know, if you go on the internet and you look up any states, P-20 systems, I mean, states all around the country are building P-20 systems. And I'm going to confess with you something. I don't understand the philosophical argument about why that's a good thing, right? Because basically it's saying that cleanliness is better than a mess, or that systematicity by itself is a good thing. And for me, that doesn't make a lick of sense. You know, I mean, I tried to present the argument as coherently as I could, but, you know, it seems to be almost a kind of Platonism, which is like there are these ideas, these standards that are good, and we should institute them the same all around the country. And I'm thinking, well, why would we do that?
Right.
For me, you know, I'm a John Stuart Millian. I think there should be lots of different experiments in living. And if some schools want to use a more traditional instructive technique and my school district wants to use a more progressive John Deweyan technique, I think that's fine. I think American education should be a landscape with a lot of different flowers.
Yeah, it seems to be less about or assume away the possibility of different kinds of methodologies of teaching and assumes, you know, so there's some overall coherent body of knowledge that, you know, from the cradle through age 20, we want our kids to know. And this kind of, you know, haphazard local approach with, you know, will not generate the best means towards, you know, internalizing that large body of knowledge. We need this sort of more rationalized approach. But that sort of has so many different kinds of assumptions built in that.
Right.
But that strikes me as something like what the reasoning has to be, right?
Well, I mean, you know, here's my candid reflection. Mike Smith was a key hire in the Bill Clinton presidential administration, and he was actually the first hire of the Obama administration in the Department of Education. And when he retired, Arne Duncan, Obama's Secretary of Education, called Mike Smith the mayor of the Department of Education. So, I mean, for me, my book, I'm trying to find who am I arguing against, and Mike Smith, and to some extent Jennifer O'Day, and you know, she was the co-author of this key article, but Mike Smith actually wrote many, many more articles sort of pressing this point. I think Mike Smith is a good engineer and a bad philosopher. He's a good engineer about explaining how to sync everything up, but he's not a good philosopher about why syncing it up is better than having sort of chaos. And one person whom I really like is Yang Zhao. And Yang Zhao is, he was born in China, but now he teaches at University of Kansas. And I mean, his whole point is that the American education system was great when it was broken, because when it was broken, there was all sorts of space for freedom, that you could have school plays and debate teams and auto body shops. And there was time for kids to play with their friends after school and play music in their garage and sort of become bands that the whole world would listen to. So Yang Zhao's whole point to us was, don't make American education into a system. Let there be this diversity that has room for freedom. So yeah, I'm 100% on Yang Zhao's side of this debate. And it really is the limits of philosophy. I mean, how do you tell somebody that diversity is better than uniformity? I mean, at a certain point, argumentation stops. You just have to say, what kind of world do you want to live in? Do you want one where everybody's marching in step? Are you okay with there being eccentrics?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm trying to think if there's anything in the curriculum that one would want to be systematized, right? Are there any particular elements? I mean, because I could see there maybe is better case for something like the hard sciences to be more systematic in nature. Although even in that case, there's a benefit to more experimentation and creativity in learning the sciences. But I'm not sure
that's a legit question. Here's something I learned from researching the book. There's no scholarly consensus on how kids learn. There's no scholarly consensus on how kids learn at the beginning. Right. And so, for me, it's obvious that kids in kindergarten should play with their hands, right? Mm-hmm. And so this is John Dewey's whole point in works such as The School and Society and The Child and the Curriculum, that the educator has to tap into the child's interest in the world to get them to want to learn, that you can't actually transport knowledge from your head into somebody else's head. All you can do is create an environment where the child learns on their own. And for me, that makes perfect sense. But you know, there are other people who say you need to get kids reading as quickly as possible. And, those people won. You know, those people won with the Common Core State Standards. I mean, one of the most controversial Common Core Standards is that says that kindergartners by the end of kindergarten must be able to read reader emergent texts with purpose and understanding. Mm-hmm. And the fact is that, like, if you say that every kid in your state has to be able to read at least on some level by the time they're in kindergarten, that means that the entire kindergarten curriculum has to be geared on getting the slowest. I mean, I don't want to use this term, right? But the kids who can't read, you have to design everything to get them to be able to read. So everything that's not in the curriculum that heads towards that goal, there's pressure to remove it. So the fact of the matter is that, like, saying something like some minimum standard about like when kids should be able to read has all sorts of consequences. Mm-hmm. Same thing that goes for math. I mean, what I realized from reading the book is that there's something called the math wars. And part of the math wars is about how you balance conceptual understanding and procedural mastery. And conceptual understanding is, do you understand the thinking behind what you're doing, and can you explain your mathematical reasoning? Procedural mastery says you just have to come up with the right answers, and that the coming up with the right answers demonstrates that you understand it sufficiently for your age. So here's a real question is, should math education emphasize word problems that kids will see in real life? Or should it emphasize just straight math? And both of them have advantages and disadvantages. Mm-hmm. So the fact is that, like, you make a reasonable thought, which says, all well-meaning educated people can identify certain basic things that children should be able to do by certain ages. And what I've done in my research is that I believe that I've shown there are no such standards. That there's always going to be very intelligent people who say, actually, I disagree about how we should educate children. That it's fine if they learn to read a little bit later, or it's fine if they could just do pure math without understanding all the word problems.
Yeah. Yeah. It strikes me there's a kind of ambiguity. I mean, since I'm not close to this debate, I don't know, but it strikes me that there's a kind of ambiguity in the notion of education standards, in that at least the way that it's discussed, education standards can either refer to how material is educated to children or what the outcomes are supposed to be, right? So it strikes me that, you know, in some ways it's reasonable, at least it's more plausible to me to make an argument to say that the sort of national government can set standards about outcomes, right? I find it, you know, reasonable that the national government can serve as an accountability force for that. But it strikes me as a lot more bizarre and less plausible to set some kinds of standards of how to teach children, since, as you say, it's so sort of so diverse how kids learn and they go at different pace. So I don't know if I mean, first of all, I don't know what do you think about that? And sort of very, are you on the same page there, or, you know, are there other people talking in these terms, or?
Yeah, no, I mean, let me try to sharpen maybe the distinctions a little bit. So, sometimes there's something called opportunity to learn standards, and those often concern inputs. And inputs are things like, if you look at what good private schools have or what wealthy suburban schools have, and then try to figure out, let's make those available to children in all schools. And so there can be a debate among what constitute opportunity to learn standards, but there can be certain a focus on inputs. Then there can be also a focus, as you were saying, on outputs. And this is saying that we don't care what schools do; we just want to see results, and we're going to hold them accountable for producing results. And so this is more about outputs. One way to think about the difference between these two camps is the difference between what's called in the scholarly literature equity and excellence. Mm. Equity says, let's provide similar opportunities for all children. The excellence paradigm says, we care about results, how kids do on tests. So the fact is that another way to think about it is that the equity paradigm is more close to John Dewey. John Dewey says the purpose of education is to raise citizens. And part of being citizens is being confident, well-rounded, assertive, comfortable articulating your position in public settings. And part of the reason you're comfortable doing that is because, you know, your whole education has worked on developing your talents and your own particular thoughts. So you've got the confidence and the desire to express yourself. So that's John Dewey's paradigm. The other paradigm is somebody closer to Milton Friedman or Gary Becker, which is more about, we need to measure your skills and make sure that you're learning your skills. And we don't care about, the words that come into mind is hippy dippy shit, but like, we don't care about if you enjoy school or if you're having fun or if you're doing school plays, right? So there are these two paradigms, the equity Dewey paradigm and the excellence Gary Becker paradigm. If you have national testing and national accountability mechanisms, I don't know how you can do that and stay within the Dewey and equity paradigm. I think that is so strongly correlated with the Becker excellence paradigm that you're pretty much going to replicate the problems if you say try to come up with a common core too, but still insist on having national education standards and testing and accountability mechanisms. So, you know, as somebody who identifies with the Dewey and democratic tradition, I'm ready to just call an end to the national education standards experiment. You know, when somebody like Jeb Bush is really pushing for, you know, he's one of the main people pushing for the Common Core in various ways. My vision of our country is different than Jeb Bush's. And I think that he's being at least strategically smart in pushing the Common Core and testing and accountability, because you're going to create a educational and political culture that has a certain character. And I'm scared to death, honestly, of what this character is. I'm scared of creating a society where there's a very small possession of haves and a huge pool of have-nots who get this kind of crummy education that's all geared around preparing for standardized tests. So to just come back to your beginning point about national accountability mechanisms, I'm against national accountability mechanisms. I would much rather have schools accountable to the people in the school district who can vote out the superintendent or can decide together about what kind of education they want for their children.
So, yeah, I mean, this gets to one of the hearts of my question. Do you think there's any role for the national government in education?
Well, you know, I mean, somebody whom I really love on this matter is Wilhelm von Humboldt, and he talks about the limits of state action. And, you know, he basically says that the state is always going to try to create citizens that does what it wants. And they want obedient worker bee soldier citizens. And so actually the passage that John Stuart Mill begins on liberty with is actually when you, there are ellipses in the quote, the epigraph, but actually when you look at the quote itself, it's about national education systems. So, you know, I'm 100% on the Humboldt, John Stuart Mill spectrum that says we have to be on constant vigilance against the national state using education to create worker bees. But, you know, I mean, I come from a liberal family. I come from a family that appreciates the great society. So, I mean, and I know that it stinks to go to a school district without sufficient resources. So I can see some role for the elementary and secondary education, giving money to states to give to their poorest school districts. So I can see that. I mean, the history of the Elementary and Secondary Education Act is just a constant ramping up of the strings attached to the money. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, I would favor way loosening the strings at the federal government and really just giving the money to states and say, we trust you, be responsible, try to help, use this money for your lowest, economic, strata school districts. But, you know, I mean, this is going to be a hard sell. Because there's got to be corruption, right? So one of the famous studies of the early Elementary and Secondary Education Act was that some school districts were using Title I funds to buy marching band uniforms. Mm-hmm. For me, that's not a scandal. Like for me, that's like, you know, if school wants to have marching bands, if give kids that community and that skill set, that's fine for me, you know, but education reformers are like, that just proves you can't trust states. That's why we have to have these federal accountability mechanisms. And I'm like, oh my God.
Sorry. I got us a little off track in the sense that, we've just been talking about one of the arguments that you bring up. The other arguments that you bring up for, and against national education standards, so mirror one another. We've been talking about the equity argument too in the last few minutes. It's interesting how, you know, you bring up a case for national standards in advancing the cause of equity, but also a case for more localism in advancing egalitarian ends. I don't know if you want to say maybe a little bit more about that. I mean, I think you said a few minutes ago about how national standards maybe are ill-equipped to advance egalitarian causes. You want to say a bit about how turning towards a more local approach can advance egalitarian ends?
Yeah. So Jesse H. Rhodes is a political scientist at UMass Amherst, and he wrote an article in Perspectives on Politics that I think is very, very illuminating for the debate. And what Rhodes shows is that No Child Left Behind passed because it had two constituencies. You had business groups among the Republicans who said that national education standards will ensure that we have a literate and numerate workforce. But it also had civil rights groups that said, we're tired of urban schools graduating our children who can't read or do math. So the famous, you know, the famous pictures of No Child Left Behind are you've got George W. Bush signing the bill, and then you've got Ted Kennedy right next to him, the lion of the Senate, the great liberal defender. They come together for No Child Left Behind. So, if you're going to stop, if you're going to turn the tide, these are the two constituencies you need to go against, or to be able to explain why they should maybe switch to the other paradigm. So part of what I try to do in my book is to draw upon people that are detailing how systemic school reform hurts communities with high percentage of children of color. And so, for example, Julian Vasquez Heilig is a researcher whom I respect. One of the things he did is that he showed the amount of time being dedicated to art class under No Child Left Behind. And so what you see is that the amount of time spent to art goes way down as a result of No Child Left Behind. So if you think that arts education is important, you might see the advantage of local control. My friend Yohuru Williams, who's now a dean at St. Thomas University in Minnesota, he talks about the devastating effects of getting rid of music programs in Title I schools, that this marching band, to go back to our early example, marching band used to be a source of pride for neighborhoods. Now with the funding redistribution, so there's no longer resources for that, and the incredible focus on taking standardized tests, you're losing these traditions. And so he wrote a great piece in Huffington Post called Rhythm and Bruise about how this education reform is hurting communities of color. So the fact of the matter is that, like, at a minimum, there are two sides to this debate, right? So I don't want to make it sound like there's not. So there's good arguments if you believe in equity for supporting national education standards. And then there's good arguments if you believe in egalitarianism for opposing national education standards. So what I do after the high theory chapters, is that I actually look at the specifics of the standards. And what I think this exercise does is it takes the bloom off the rose. Right. So if you ask a room of 30 people and say, do you believe in high education standards? 30 hands are going to go mm-hmm. up, right? Nobody's in principle against high education standards. But then if you look at the standards and say, this is the kind of education that's going to result from implementing these standards. Now all of a sudden the debate changes a little bit and people say, oh gosh, that's not as good as I thought it would be. Or, oh wow, that's a really high opportunity cost we have to get rid of all sorts of things we value to meet this particular standard that we had minimal say in articulating. That's what I hope my book does, is I hope that people read it and say, oh wow, like we've committed a huge amount of time and resources into national education standards that maybe just aren't so good. And maybe we should risk having more local control, and maybe we should risk democracy, letting communities have meaningful debates amongst themselves about how to make the local schools better.
Yeah. The other surprising argument that you make is, again, counterintuitive. You think that one of the cases for national education standards is, as you say, an economic argument, right? So that you sort of develop a coherent curriculum to educate children to become the next generation of entrepreneurs in a world economy. But then on the flip side, you say in the next chapter, this was a very interesting bit, that there's a kind of entrepreneurial argument to be made on the local side, that, you know, the pluralism and experimentation of the American school system at the local level helps foster a kind of experimentalism and entrepreneurialism that one might be worried is stifled in the kind of lockstep national education standards of, say, a Common Core. So that it's a sort of turning on its head in an interesting way of one of the main cases, which often in these kinds of, you know, like you used to see this at the university level too, right? These kinds of attempts to introduce more accountability mechanisms and more attach more federal dollars in order to for utilitarian or economic ends. It's in a way self-defeating.
Absolutely. I mean, Christopher Tinkin is a scholar whom I respect. And one of the ways that he makes this argument is to look at patents. And, they're like frivolous patents. So that can skew the data. So you have to remove the frivolous patents. But if you look at the significant patents, it's that America is lapping the world, or at least has been lapping the world. So the fact of the matter is that we were doing something right, you know, and, the fact of the matter, and Yang Zhao, to go back to an earlier thinker I was discussing, he's got some very poignant descriptions of how the Chinese education system crushes, eccentric students, or crushes students who don't do well on standardized tests, even though they could be amazing at other opportunities or other activities. So Arne Duncan, he gave a speech in where he was talking about the Program for International Student Assessment, PISA, and he was saying, you know, the lesson that we have to learn is that the United States should emulate countries like Shanghai. And I'm listening to this and I'm thinking, well, you know, if we have the education system of Shanghai, soon we're going to have the political culture of Shanghai. And is that what we want? And one of the reasons this chapter just draws upon Tinkin and Yang Zhao is to say, it's also not clear that this is better economically. I mean, yes, we want entrepreneurs who take risks, who are who are encouraged to think for themselves and are not stunned every time they step off the bright yellow line.
Yeah. The last argument that I just wanted to mention quickly ask you about briefly is the really actually kind of central to your argument, which is the democratic capacities argument. I mean, on the one hand, you say national education standards can make a case for promising to foster the sort of skills and capacities necessary for democratic citizenship. But on the other hand, there's a compelling case that can be made for localism, in the sense that if you're a parent or if you're a child who's actually actively involved in forming, developing the curriculum, you're actually doing the work of citizenship. It's an argument that runs quite clearly through Alexis de Tocqueville, John Stuart Mill, and up through through John Dewey. I'm assuming you find the localism case more persuasive than the national case.
Yeah. Well, Deborah Meyer is somebody whom I greatly respect. And she wrote this book she wrote an article in the Boston Review in 1999 called Will Standards Save Education? And this book, to my mind, anticipated nearly all of the issues that would arise because of No Child Left Behind in the Common Core. Like, incredibly far-sighted analysis of the problem with national education standards. And one of Deborah Meyer's points is that the way that children learn democracy is to watch adults make meaningful decisions. Mm-hmm. So right now, in the school, if you're a student, your teacher has no say about the standards, often has no say about the curriculum. If that teacher goes above and beyond the call of duty to help a child or to nurture a child's special interests, there's nothing in the system that will reward them. There's actually potentially things that will punish them. So you've basically weakened the capacity of teachers. The exact same thing happens with principals and superintendents, right? They're not given any discretion about the aims of education. They're simply told to enforce top-down mandates. But there's also the community that now, like, you know, if I have a problem with my school district, I've given up talking to my local principals and superintendents, right? Because they're not the ones in charge, right? They're perfectly fine, nice people. I just think that they're not the ones who are in charge. And Jesse H. Rhodes, again, wrote a really great article in Political Behavior called Learning Citizenship. And he said, actually, the data confirms that top-down education reform alienates parents from the schools, but also from the political process more generally. So the fact of the matter is, if parents don't have a meaningful voice in the schools, they're not going to want to volunteer for PTA. They're not going to run for school board. I mean, in New York right now, it makes absolutely no sense. Well, I'm injecting my own opinion, I think it makes minimal sense to run for school board right now in New York because you don't have very much control. So what Jesse H. Rhodes shows is that this has a ripple effect that people just check out from the political process. And, you know, Tocqueville called it in the 19th century. He said, this is the problem of individualism. People are just going to retreat into their own house, into the solitude of their own hearts and just stop caring about political life. And for somebody who cares about democracy, this is a destination to be avoided.
Yeah. And it's also, the Tocqueville connection I think is good because it's also at once the development of a new kind of soft despotism, right? That of the tutelary state where everyone becomes like children, walking in lockstep to the parent figure of the national government.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, this, it could be, we'd be having a different conversation if the standards were good.
Yeah.
Well, but the fact that there's such bad standards really, I've met very few parents who are like, I oppose the Common Core because I believe in federalism.
Right.
I mean, that's not what happens. Or, you know, I read Tocqueville and that's why, I mean, what I'm trying to do in the book is to try to articulate reasons why parents are correct that this system needs to change, that it's just not good. It's not good for students. It's not good for teachers. It's not good for neighborhoods. It's not good for our country.
Yeah. I mean, this in part goes back to a little bit of the politics of it, but, I'm wondering whether on your view, it's better politically to move towards a more responsible national standards or better to sort of ally oneself with libertarians like DeVos and sort of, return to more decentralization, localism. I mean, have you thought about, this is one of the questions I had, the libertarian, I mean, obviously you're not a libertarian, you're Deweyan, but what do you think about school choice as a way to, in the school choice movement as a way to think about how to, address accountability in a different way rather than democratically. This is through market mechanisms and it's closer at least. I mean, maybe it's closer. I don't know. Maybe it's further away from what you have in mind.
No, that's right. Actually, I have a stack in my office of articles and books. I think that's actually my next article. So,
good.
That I want
get a preview
because,
yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. If any of the reviewers are listening, please be kind. But no, I mean, I basically think that, in a modern world, people need to have exercise some autonomy and that, right now, actually in America, it's School Choice Week right now. And, it's a little bit painful because I have a lot of friends who are very active on social media right now saying, school choice is a scam and that public schools are a treasure. Part of my argument is that right now, public schools are not a treasure. Right. Public schools right now are a scene of a lot of misery and, inane pedagogy and over testing and, the worst among us are filled with passion and intensity for their schemes for transforming education, for making it more and more online and making it more and more controlled and marginalizing personal relationships, which I think are key to the education endeavor. So I'm lukewarm about the reality of public education in our country right now. And also I think that school choice has a legitimate point that parents want to feel invested in their kids' education. They don't want to feel like they have to send their kids to prison. They want to feel like they have some say about how their children are going to be exercised. So I do think that this is an overlap between a certain kind of libertarianism and John Dewey. I'll just say as an aside, I don't think it makes sense to describe Betsy DeVos as a libertarian. I think that she's a neoliberal. And what I mean by that is that, neoliberals want to use the state to create the markets and that neoliberals, or at least certain kind of neoliberals, see the role in the states in shaping a kind of citizen who can participate in the market economy. So somebody like Neil McCluskey at the Cato Institute, I like Neil. We agree on a lot of things, right? And so, one of the things that I like about Neil is he says people should be able to choose a Deweyan model. And I say, okay, then we're on the same page. Then we're on the same page, Neil. But then there are other people, who are saying that, well, it's the role of the federal government to create the market in which that people can compete. And part of creating the market is coming up with these national education standards, and people can choose between public or charter schools to meet these academic standards of the Common Core. And I want to say that has nothing to do with freedom. And, I believe in freedom. So, in the politics of the Common Core, I'm happy to sometimes work with libertarians at the Heartland Institute, with the Progressive, American Principles Project, with the Cato Institute, acknowledging that we disagree about a lot of things, including about how we might like to educate our own children. But I do agree with them that communities and parents have to have a say in how children are educated.
So I wanted to zero in on some of the details of the Common Core just before we conclude here. A few of the parts of it that were striking to me. Again, I had the impression, maybe the same impression that all parents do when first reading it, which is that it sounds quite reasonable, right? The overall standards. But then when you actually look at the details, it seems quite bizarre. So the English language arts and literacy standards, to start with, there is an emphasis on close reading, use of textual evidence to develop an argument, the rejection of what students tend to do sometimes, which is generally kind of emote in the direction of the text, right? You quote someone in this part of this movement, he says something like, we don't give a shit about what you think, right? We want you to learn about how to analyze a text. And that all sounds, I read that. I said, that's great. I would want more of that out of our students. So what's the problem?
Okay. So, the fact is that people have been providing evidence from texts since Aristotle read Plato, right? So that's not a new thing. And pretty much my entire career, I've had to provide evidence for texts. And, that's one of the scholarly tools of the trade, right? The question is that the Common Core standards emphasize providing text-dependent and text-specific evidence. So pretty much every single Common Core assignment that tests ELA, what it does is it provides you with a passage of text, and then it asks you to answer questions from the text using the exact words from the text. So what school is becoming right now is that in English class, you're given a passage of text, and then you are given There are 10 anchor standards, but the 10th one is a little bit different. So there's basically the first standard is just saying the basic principle of providing evidence from the text. So really it's standards 2 through 9 specify what kind of evidence to provide from the text to answer questions about the text. So English class, you're giving a little piece of text and you're supposed to answer questions about it. When you go to history class, you're given a passage about a history and you're supposed to answer questions about the text using the exact words from the text. Believe it or not, when you talk about art class being aligned with the Common Core, can you follow the logic, right? You're given a passage about art and you have to answer questions about it. As it turns out, this is a skill that's very easy to test on computers. And the whole Race to the Top framework emphasizes testing on computers. So I myself don't think that the philosophy is that serious. I think that it's just to cover for this desire for the state to create an online testing system. So what's the problem with this? What you're telling children is from ages kindergarten or from grade kindergarten to 12th grade that they are never allowed to articulate their own perspective. So John Dewey, when he talked about the school and society, he talked about a Copernican revolution in education where you really focus on the child and what makes school or life interesting for them and use that as a resource to get them to study and to learn more. This is the exact opposite of John Dewey's methodology, because now it's telling kids, shut up, keep your thoughts to yourself, answer these questions in this way that's going to be exact same for every other student in this class. You are just another brick in the wall. That's just my restating of it, right? And the fact is that like So it's not like that I'm in favor of emoting more. It's that I'm in favor of freedom, right? So that when I was in school, I mean, the things that got my adrenaline going were things where you're told, Nick, you need to do a research assignment. And there can be certain broad parameters, but these are the things you're allowed to research. So when I was in high school, I wrote a long paper on Italian intervention in the Spanish Civil War. And so this was me researching and really trying to find texts and making connections to all sorts of different sources to make an argument. That's not what the Common Core is about. The Common Core is about being provided with the text, so you don't choose the text, and then you have to answer questions about the text that you don't choose the text, or you don't get to choose how to answer the questions. So, I mean, for me, as a political scientist, political philosopher, is that I'm thinking, all right, what are you teaching children when you do this methodology? And what you're telling them is keep your thoughts to yourself. Meanwhile, at the good private school down the road, kids are being taught to think for themselves. Mm-hmm. You know, so Arne Duncan, he pulled his kids out of public school and sent them to the lab school at University of Chicago, and they don't follow the Common Core. Right. So what you're going to have is you're going to have a small stratum of wealthy kids who are taught to think for themselves, and everybody else who are taught to obey orders and follow instructions. And as a parent, I'm not going to stand for that. Right. No way am I going to stand for that. Like, yes, I want my kids to provide evidence, but I also want them to think for themselves. And the Common Core, at least the standards themselves, provide minimal space for that to happen.
Yeah. And not to mention, it also assumes that texts are open to only one interpretation. I mean, so many of the great texts that we read, I mean, part of the interest in working with them is that they're open to different interpretations, which is another thing that activates students' imaginations, right? So it's not that students emote in the general direction of the text, but that they can bring their experience to bear to pick out different salient features of a text and develop different kinds of interpretations about them. And it strikes me that this kind of approach closes that down. It treats texts more like, again, I mean, I'm struck that it seems like more of a kind of hard science model of thinking about knowledge rather than a kind of humanities model where it's more on an interpretive basis.
Well, you know, sometimes people say that David Coleman, who's the lead writer of the ELA standards, they say that he's sort of reviving new literary criticism, which focuses on the text. Mm-hmm. I don't think that theory is plausible because he doesn't cite any new literary criticism. Mm-hmm. I mean, he has a background in test score analytics. So, I mean, I think this is there's this literature on autonomous technology, which says that technology can have repercussions on human affairs in ways that human beings might not even be aware of and might not even desire. And if they knew in advance what it would lead to, they might not support it. I mean, the classic example of this is Frankenstein, right? That you have all these expectations about what's going to happen, and then it comes to life, and then you realize, oh my gosh, like this is not what I wanted to have happen. So the fact is that, like, I don't think there's a good justification for Common Core close reading. And really what I want this chapter and then the book as a whole to do is to say, listen, what you're doing is you're taking this legitimate skill that's part of the scholarly repertoire, isolating it and putting way too much emphasis on it. And what you're doing is you're just distorting the whole educational experience.
So one of the other striking things that comes through in the other, some of the other chapters, notably on history and in the chapter on sexuality, is that you identify kind of political leanings that find their way in the Common Core. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about those. The worry is that, of course, inserting a sort of tendentious political or ideological view into a national education standard can make a lot of, say, people on the other ideological side mad. And it's not maximally inclusive of the other side. So maybe you could say a little bit about that. I mean, pick history or sexuality, and we could talk about those.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, part of what my book wants to do is show the connection between all these debates that maybe people don't realize how closely they're connected. And this is just, Thomas Piketty says that scholars are just people who have a lot of time to do research, who have the privilege to do a lot of research. So, you know, that's how I viewed myself, that I had the privilege to be on sabbatical and just read huge mountains of literature about all of these standards and connect pattern and see patterns and make connections. So, there was a big hullabaloo in 2014 about the advanced placement AP US history or advanced placement US history exam, APUSH. And the objections were largely coming from conservatives who said that this has got a left-wing progressive agenda and that they're underplaying the importance of American identity. Right. So the College Board came up with a revised version of the AP standards. Some people, like Max Eden at the American Enterprise Institute, says actually these standards are good. Conservatives should support these standards. But then Stanley Kurtz, he responded at the College Board is saying that the AP program doesn't need to change any of its curricular materials, which just confirms that all of these changes are cosmetic, which I happen to agree with. But the question here is that do you think that any one body or any one faction should be able to determine how American history is taught? And, you know, to make a side glance, is there any one faction on sexuality education that determines how it should be taught? And, what I wanted to argue is that no, that part of what makes American experience great is that we have space for competing narratives. And so the fact is that, you know, I am sympathetic to the conservatives who are mad at the AP program for delegitimizing their perspectives. Right. And my point here is that it's not because I'm a conservative. It's because I'm a pluralist, because I'm a Democrat, because I realize that the American agon needs to keep going. The American contest over ideals needs to keep going. I wrote my dissertation on Kant. I wrote my book on Kant. You know, you and I are both Kant scholars. You know, I believe in daring to know and thinking for yourself and things like that. But that doesn't mean that you should indoctrinate high school kids. So that's really what I'm against. I'm against the indoctrination that national education standards make possible. And that's, you know, that's one of the objections against close reading is that it's telling kids you have to provide evidence from the text and you're not allowed to disagree with the text or make or interject your own perspective into these policy debates. And, you know, I want there to be space for lots of competing political perspectives in America.
You know, I was curious about that. I mean, this point that you make, I think, is so powerful. But in one way, I wonder if, and I wonder your reaction about this too, is if this kind of argument is becoming harder for people to accept. I mean, they might accept it in theory, but not in practice. And by that, I mean this, which is something like, I mean, yes, we could say, okay, we, you know, want to make sure no one particular faction takes over, in part because when the shoe's on the other foot, then someone else will, impose on me the standards I don't like. But when your team is in power, it's particularly tempting to, you know, extend one's reach, to impose one's will. And it strikes me in the case of education too, in particular, it's even more tempting because we're talking about the next generation, our children and so forth. I don't know what you think about that. I mean, as far as, do you think that this is becoming more difficult to take that? I mean, it's a kind of meta step, a step back from the truth or falsity of one's own position to the step of a kind of pluralist step. Do you think that's a harder step to make, or is it still possible to make?
No, I think that's exactly, I think that's a legitimate question. I mean, if I could just step back for a minute, in my previous book on Deleuze, I had a chapter on John Stuart Mill and Deleuze and John Stuart Mill, when he was writing on Liberty, him and Harriet Taylor, they were, I think they were afraid that they were, wait, I don't think they were suffering from tuberculosis, but there was a tuberculosis scare in London and they thought they both might die. And so they write on Liberty to try to give humanity hope in the values of liberty and different experiments of living. And actually, when you read about the context of John Stuart Mill's On Liberty, that there wasn't a natural audience for the text, right? Because the workers were concerned about getting more economic benefits, and the aristocrats were concerned with preserving their privileges. So as far as there being like a liberal intelligentsia or a natural constituency for John Stuart Mill, like there wasn't. So, you know, I at least look back to John Stuart Mill as a kind of hero, because he's like, he was alone and he was trying, well, maybe not entirely alone. He had Harriet Taylor, but he had some friends. But I mean, the point is that it was not propitious circumstances. And I think that, so we're not in propitious circumstances right now. I think you've identified the correct dynamic, that people want to go for the kill and say, all right, now we can, teach all of Americans the correct way to view all of these different topics. And, you know, part of what I want my argument to do is to really, you know, I grew up in liberal communities, and I basically want to say, listen, guys and girls, look at the specifics of the standards and recognize the problem. So even if you could get your way, please recognize the incredible consequences that are going to result from doing that. And, you know, what else can we do other than make our best argument and see what happens?
Yeah. It points to a problem that I've talked to several others on this podcast about, which is the problem of polarization in America. And I mean, what strikes me that one of the consequences of polarization, you know, kind of extreme polarization, is that it feeds into the, you know, the broad centralization of power in national government, of course, because the way to win in a polarized system is to control national government. So yeah, I mean, as I said, this is particularly acute, it strikes me, in the case of education, and I think all the more needed in order to sort of arrest this problem of polarization.
Yeah, well, you know, one thing I tell people is that I'm not a spectator. I'm an actor in this game, right? That yes, Hamilton is winning. Hamilton is the star of a Broadway show. Obama loved Hamilton. As soon as you know, Mike Pence goes to see Hamilton, he gets a little lecture. But the fact is that there's this very strong Hamiltonian drive in our country to keep making the executive power stronger and stronger and stronger, and enforce your vision on the entire country. And yeah, that's right. And so I identify with this tradition of Thomas Jefferson and James Madison that says, let there be more participatory democracy. Let there be freedom. Let there be differences among people. Reasonable people disagree about how to teach math. Let them disagree. Why should the federal government put its finger on the scales and try to say, all right, listen, this is the philosophy of math education that's going to govern the entire country. You know, I mean, one really great thing about the Common Core fight is that I've met all sorts of people. And then you realize that people are much more complicated than you give them credit for. That I have a friend, Shannon Joy, who does conservative talk radio. She's on right after Rush Limbaugh. She's had me on her show, you know? So she's had me on her show to debates. I've published lots of things in Al Jazeera America, which, you know, it's a great, great outlet. I'm very sad it's gone. But, you know, the editor was on the left. And so, you know, I had to sort of just make sure that the argument could be plausible from a left-wing perspective. So, you know, the fact is that, yes, situation looks dire. Right now, across America, kids are doing the Common Core. But the fact of the matter is that Americans we still like rebels. We still believe, at least in principle and democracy. You know, the reformers still have to try to speak the language of federalism and democracy and liberty. So that, you know, it's hypocritical, but hypocrisy is the compliment that vice pays to virtue. So, you know, the right principles are still in circulation. So, you know, let's see what this book can do. This book is not a description of a debate. This book is really trying to intervene in the debate.
Yeah. And this is, that strikes me, lots of the points that you raise are the kinds of ones that can be the subject of reasonable disagreement in a way that, I mean, sorry, one of the ways in which polarization in America is maintained is a lot of these sort of hot button issues we keep on hammering away on in American public life. And perhaps if we started talking a little bit more about math standards or English standards, we could engage in more reasonable disagreement and have respect for the other side, not think the other side is evil or a threat to the country or some such thing. What I mean to say is that this is, I think you're pointing towards ways to open up discussion in a way that we really haven't had. You know, as you said, these kinds of movements were sort of sprung on the American people, but, you know, a way that we haven't had, but in ways that can possibly cut across different political leanings, can, form coalitions that are sort of unexpected between left and right. What do you think about that?
Yeah, no, I mean, I just published an article in Eon, which is a kind of intellectual mm-hmm. journal. And it was called Treat People as Citizens. And I wrote that while thinking about the book, because the question is that a lot of my book, the argument relies on democracy. And the question becomes, well, why democracy, right? There are all sorts of people right now, political theorists, who are saying it's time for epistocracy. The smart people should be in charge now, that people are stupid and they don't know enough about things. And you know, the argument that I make in that piece is that says, if people don't have a reason to participate in politics, they are going to be ignorant.
Right.
And if people are taught by our system to just stay home and watch TV, then they are going to vote for television celebrities for office. So the fact is that I want a citizenry that's full of people who have a reason to do their homework, to meet their neighbors, to campaign, to try to do their homework on these issues so they can participate meaningfully in these debates. So, you know, I mean, the big question of the book is, are we going to fight for our democracy? And if you believe in democracy where you sort of have civically muscular citizens, then you need to devolve education control to the local level. But if you want to go the opposite way and say, we're just going to gamble that the right people will be in charge, well, I guess you can stick with national education standards. I myself am opposed to that. I'd rather have citizenry that's, you know, people are going to the school board, they're active in their school kids' education. This is firing them up to run for higher office and to become more educated about issues. That's the America that I want to have.
Yeah, well, it's a inspiring ideal and a really rigorous critique of the Common Core. And I thank you so much for writing the book, Nick. And thanks for joining me today on the Political Theory Review.
It was a wonderful conversation. Thanks so much for having me on your show.
You've been listening to the Political Theory Review. Find us on the web and on iTunes. Thanks to the Starting Points Journal for partnering with us. And thanks to you for listening.